we're talking about the minor courts, which have how many judges?
23.
Right, and those courts are 23, in turn, are in charge of even smaller courts, which have
three
judges. Right. So there's a system in which the courts are supposed to be in charge of each other, much like you have in the secular government. Right, you have the courts of appeal, the circuit courts, and the Supreme Court, at least in the United States. Ideally speaking, that's the way it was supposed to be at the time, that's the way it was at the time when there was a Beis HaMikdash. And also, the judges were tested for their unique qualities to be judges. Not like, they weren't voted into office. Could be they were voted after they were found to be eligible, but they really have to be adept at many, many things, including they have to have a vast amount of secular knowledge. Because it was not sufficient just to know Torah in order to be a good judge, but rather you also had to know secular knowledge and preferably also many languages. So if the witnesses came who will only speak a foreign language, you'd be able to question the witnesses and be able to understand fully what they're saying without having an interpreter translate for you.
Are there any judges with these qualities anywhere at all? Anywhere?
No.
Anywhere?
No.
There's no basement, even in all of Israel, where the judges know multiple languages and secular information as well as Torah?
It could be there is, but if it is, it's not particularly well known. It's hard to say there is no such place.
On the South African and YouTube rabbis, PhD in law as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the problem with the British system is that very often nowadays, what is it?
You have a place where they know also languages that people made up and you didn't tell it to them?
No, there is no place like that. The problem with the British system is that generally, at least in recent years, the rabbis who were appointed chief rabbis were not the greatest scholars. It became more of a political appointment. I don't know if that's the case in South Africa. Maybe he is a big scholar.
He is a big scholar.
Okay, then that's good.
He's a big scholar with political connections. You don't get much better.
Okay. So what happens in the Sanhedrin again is that you have people who have vast, vast knowledge, and they have the authorization for going back to Moshe Rabbeinu in order to judge. And therefore we expect that the judgment will be just and proper. Nowadays, the system, as I mentioned, is subject to all sorts, particularly outside the State of Israel. State of Israel, the Jewish courts are monitored. They are, officially recognized, they're officially monitored. There's a system, a hierarchy. In the United States and other countries of this sort, there is no such hierarchy, there is no monitoring. The basin really has no jurisdiction whatsoever, except that two people are going to come in front of a court, only if two people come in front of a court and sign a document, a binding arbitration, can the ruling of the basin be enforced. Otherwise, no way to enforce it in a secular milieu. So therefore, really, the basin's powers are very severely curtailed, and they're very limited, and even then, they're subject to a lot of pressure. In the ideal situation, the Torah now gives three commandments to judges. And the first commandment is, Lo tasu ovel b'mishpat. Do not do anything which is...
I got the balance.
Excellent.
What is it?
Okay, lo tasu ovel b'mishpat. So it says
a quarter of a dollar.
Right. Lo tasu ovel b'mishpat. Do not do anything improper. How does the article translate ovel?
Comes with the provision of justice.
What?
Was it the translation?
Yeah.
You shall not commit the provision of justice.
Perversion of justice. Okay. So that means to twist justice. You're not allowed to twist it. The word ovel is an interesting word. Ovel is Rabbi Shem Shof Polher says that it means to take advantage of something, and to take advantage of something improperly. In other words, you're a judge, you've got a lot of power, so therefore you can exercise that power in all sorts of ways which are illicit and improper. For example, you can extort bribes from the litigants who come in front of you. So what my Torah is saying, you can't use your power in order to distort the judgment. And this way I think the word ovel is related to the word ol, which is spelled the same way. Ayin, vav, lamed, ayin, vav, lamed, different vowels. What does the word ol mean with ayin, vav, lamed? Anybody know?
Ol,
a yoke. A yoke, right. So yoke is a harness which you put on a horse or an ox to apply your mastery to that animal.
Oh.
So too, the judge is being told not to apply mastery to the litigant. So this is an important thing, because it's not for the judge to be a master. It's for a king to be a master. It's for it's for the whatever other powers exist to be masters, but not the judge. All the judge is supposed to do is render judgment. Okay? And it's not supposed to take advantage of his position. So that's the first thing which we tell the judge. And again, if you do, then you lose your entire authority. Your entire authority is that you are going to now impose impartial judgment as opposed to impose your power. I think I might have told you there's an interesting response by the Chuchavus lawyer, who lived, if I recall correctly, in Germany in the 17th century. He was asked once by a non-Jew, this is printed in his paper, he was asked by a non-Jew, how come Jews always bribe the judges? Right? It says in the Torah not to bribe, not here.
Just opposite.
What?
It's just opposite.
Say what?
To bribe the judge.
Right.
As the Torah.
So the Torah says not to bribe the judge, yet Jews are going around all the time bribing judges. So how come it seems to be improper, right? So the Chavisur had a very sharp and very interesting answer. His answer was that the reason you're not allowed to give a judge a bribe is because you might incline the balance of that judge's impartiality towards you, and it'll be partial towards you, right? So therefore, let's say this is one litigant and this is the other litigant, so it's got to be impartial. So if you give a bribe, it becomes partial towards you. So therefore, now it's your bribe. But the Chavis Yoreh says, when a Jew comes in front of a non-Jew for judgment, they start out down here, right? They start out at a disadvantage, at a handicap. So therefore, they get bribed just in order to bring it up to an even keel. Not in order to gain the advantage, but not to suffer from the disadvantage.
I just had a question about that, because it seems that he's prosecuting out of the reason of the mitzvah rather than just stuff, which we're all told we cannot do with threat of death, is to say, well, the mitzvah is for this purpose, since this purpose doesn't apply here, we don't have to do this mitzvah. But you seem to be applying that logic to here. Like, since you're not allowed to bribe because of that judgment of this, but it should be that you shouldn't be allowed to bribe anyway, no matter what, because it's just a mitzvah.
Right, so there wasn't the real answer. The real answer is that these are not just courts, and therefore the prohibition of giving bribes doesn't apply. Because if I don't give the bribe, he's going to take the other guy's bribe. So therefore, that's the real answer, but he couldn't say it that way. So therefore, he said it in a more politically correct fashion. Right? Now, that's the first point. Not to impose your power. On the other end, you have two prohibitions here, which are fascinating, or I shouldn't say on the other end, it's a kind of continuation. It says, Lo sisa p'nei dal, do not uplift the face of a poor person. Belosa says, Lo tehedar p'nei gadol. And do not give glory, in other words, do not give majesty to a person who is a great person. Now, Rashi explains, probably the article brings down, but Rashi explains here that Lo tehedar p'nei dal, do not lift up the countenance, the face of a poor person. Don't say, this person is poor. Even though he really is liable, he's poor, and the rich guy has got to support him. Because that's halacha, you have to give tzedakah. So therefore, I have an idea. I'm going to find the rich person guilty, and he's going to have to pay, and that way the rich person will get the reward for giving tzedakah, and the poor person will get the money which he needs. Right? So it's very legitimate, right? So the Torah says, no, you can't do that. And the same thing the Torah says the other way. Lo sedar p'nei gadol means do not give glory to the great person. You might say, this person is a great and important person. How can I embarrass him? And Rashi says, brings a powerful, expresses a powerful thing. He says, maybe I'm going to be punished by God for demeaning this great person by finding him guilty. So therefore, I have to find him. I have to find him innocent. And later on, behind closed doors, behind the scenes, out of the limelight, we'll take care of making setting things right. So the Torah tells you can't do that either.
What if this great person is a rabbi, a great rabbi, and you want to show him the respect and the praise of the rabbi?
Yeah. So actually, what they do in certain courts of America, which I think is despicable. You know what despicable means?
Not despicable.
Spelled differently, but disgusting.
Okay.
Is that certain courts will not subpoena? In other words, they won't demand that a rabbi come to court. Let's say I have litigation. I want to bring a lawsuit against the rabbi for whatever reason. So the certain courts in America will not call a rabbi to court to judge him because of the honor of the Torah. I think it's ludicrous.
Surely if a rabbi was
really?
Right.
Really?
Isn't it directly against the Torah?
What?
It's directly against the Torah.
The rationale, it's only directly against the Torah if our courts are real courts. Our courts are anyway just, you know, boards of arbitration. So therefore...
Rav, surely if a rabbi was that great, he wouldn't be in court in the first place.
Why not?
What if he's done something wrong?
Someone's suing him for damages, like that they tripped on his sidewalk. And
I don't think the Americans would do that.
There's going to be suspicious. They're going to
Wait, you're going to go see the rabbi? Want to try cases of rabbis? So what, is he innocent?
I think the rabbi would want to go to court to just show...
Why, that's despicable. You don't get to go to court now. You should be happy.
What?
You should be happy.
Who?
You.
No.
Me?
They're not going to try you.
No, unfortunately, it doesn't find me. I'm not the rabbi of a congregation. I don't work for
that. I don't believe in that.
You don't believe it actually happened?
No, I don't believe it.
Okay, so maybe it doesn't, but somebody who actually wanted to take a rabbi who based in Frisklander was based in...
Frisklander?
Oh, Beit Din. Frisklander means
to say bad things about him.
That's what I'm saying. If you touch a guy's drugs, he wouldn't be...
Hold on. Take him to the Jewish court? Take him to the...
Jewish court.
The Jewish court.
Right.
I'm thinking you're talking about...
No, of course, they'll take anything.
Don't take anything. I'm saying
they'll take the Pope.
Right.
So the Jewish court, don't take him... Because he's supposed to take him instead.
Of course.
Doesn't matter. It's right here. You should not don't favor the poor, and you should not honor the great.
So the question is, the great is the rabbi.
Right.
Should they show him a respect? You're a rabbi. You're a big.
And the answer is no.
He has not done something wrong if he's appearing in court.
Why?
Well, then why would he go?
I can go to court today and file a lawsuit against you for $1 million.
And if I'm innocent, I'll go and I'll win my case.
Yeah, but you have to go to court. Okay, I understand what they're probably doing. If they're doing that, they probably don't want to embarrass him and cause him embarrassment.
Right.
Of even bringing him in. Even if
he won't respect him.
No, he went to court, so he must have gotten away with it, and therefore.
I understand the theory of the rabbis. There are three people not that righteous. It's just like anybody can take anybody to court, you know?
Right.
Yeah, but the rabbis, to every generation.
Maybe they're afraid of people who just go up to rabbis they don't like and defame them. Then the rabbi loses.
Right, they could be afraid of anything, but the question is then who do you define who gets a day in court and who doesn't get a day in court?
Yeah, well, if I have papers for you, though. I can't
hold in
the Jewish court.
That's right. You know,
I studied with a rabbi who was in Beit Din, Queens.
Yeah.
Rabbi Daniel Cohen. He's in the Beit Din of Queens.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to ask him. This is really interesting.
Yeah. There are only a few. I don't know which part they did have which practices, but there's a friend of mine told me that he actually, as I said, wanted to bring a rabbi to one of the major courts in New York, and the court refused to hear the case simply because they didn't hear cases against rabbis. Okay? Now, so the pasuk is saying here, don't favor a poor person, and don't give false honor to which person? Of course, the verbs are different, because you don't have to give honor to a poor person. You have to do favor for him, and therefore it's two separate words which you're using, but the idea is the same. It's interesting, by the way, it's a fascinating and difficult thing to understand, that the word said tzedakah, which means charity, is based on the word tzedek, which means justice. And they seem to be diametrically opposed concepts, don't they? Because tzedakah means to give and incline towards somebody. And tzedek means to be balanced and carefully neutral, impartial, not inclined towards anybody. So what would you say? Why is the word tzedakah derived from tzedek?
Either justice is actually a kindness, but it's fair justice, or you can say that charity is not a kindness, it's just justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you'll have to say one of those two, that's
right.
True. But, so getting back to the Chavetz Chaim's idea, which is, you know, writing the imbalance, so the justice involved in giving tzedakah is that this poor person should be brought back into some degree of balance towards society. So therefore, that's what causes tzedakah is like tzedek. In a court case, then the two litigants, somebody is, usually speaking, somebody is in the wrong. And so therefore, justice is tilted towards that person disproportionately. So judgment comes to straighten it out, to flatten out the playing field. The same thing with tzedakah, it comes to flatten out the playing field and bring things back to an equilibrium. Which is an interesting idea, which not always is understood, because the Jewish system works very differently than the non-Jewish system. In the Jewish system, there are no punitive damages, except in very rare cases. You know what punitive damages are? No?
What? Punishment.
Punitive damages, right. Damages are, let's say, a woman's, classic case, right? A woman spills hot coffee from McDonald's on herself, right? So how much did it cost her to heal herself from the burns? Probably,
yeah.
20. I got it. I understand. You just give for the damage that you caused, but not for the
suffering. No, the other one, no. The 20, the probably she has to pay $20, because that was her copay on her insurance, right? So then, the jury can award such a woman millions of dollars, or at least, which has happened. Why? Because punitive damages, they want to sock it to McDonald's, you know what I mean? Because they want to make an example of McDonald's and show, this is wrong. Therefore, we're going to punish you and make you pay far more than the actual value of the damage which you caused. Right? We don't have that concept in Judaism. There's no such thing as punitive damages. There are a couple of places, very rare, we impose a fine. We impose double the amount which you did wrong, quadruple, quintuple,
stealing
rights. But that's a rarity, and it's usually in regular court case that would not happen. Certainly, a court case where there were damages, torts, as we say in law. But this case, in particular cases, that is extremely, extremely prevalent. So there's a so that idea we don't have in Judaism. We don't have the idea of punitive damages, and as a result, what really a judge justice is about is, again, there's an imbalance, righting the balance. It's not supposed to be, and let us now impose on society a new standard by giving punitive damages. But stop it to McDonald's so that everybody knows in the future not to make too hot coffee. Yeah.
But could you notice that? It's a stupid example. But can you notice that with McDonald's, all of the years of them giving too hot coffee to millions and millions and millions of people by awarding those punitive damages, like their side is gone down for her, it was only a small increment, but collectively the punitive damages is like a huge amount, because they've been doing it for years and years and years, it's all only one person.
They do it because people want
money, though.
They do it because people want hot coffee, it's not like doing it the money.
They don't get the millions of dollars.
Anyway, the first, yeah.
But the principle, what I'm trying to say is, maybe it's punitive damages because it's an ongoing thing.
A cumulative effect.
That would
have
made sense, because the next person that burns themselves won't get the, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but they won't do it anymore.
They
learned their lesson, so they won't do it anymore.
What about...
That implies that the judges have the responsibility of directing society. The Torah says that's not the responsibility. They're not supposed to direct society. They're supposed to judge... I wonder how many countries in the world actually do have punitive damages. I don't know how it works. There's another interesting difference between the American system, not all systems are like this, particularly not the French system, but the American system and Jewish law, which is that in the American system, in the truest sense, we're not looking to establish justice. We're looking to see who puts on the best act.
100%.
Right, because you have to convince the jury of your guilt or innocence.
Right.
And the jury actually tries, the judge is supposed to remain kind of aloof, and the jury then, except in the case which bench trials that are done by the judge, and the jury is then supposed to decide who put on the better performance. You know, was it the
people are judges, basically.
What?
People
are judges. But besides that, the jury is not allowed to pursue the truth on their own. A member of a jury who goes to a crime scene on their own is kicked off the jury. Because they can only judge based on what is presented to them in court. They are not allowed to ascertain on their own what truth is. This is a unique system. Most systems in the world are not like that. The
yeah,
British system is not like that.
French. The whole jury system.
What?
Most systems have abandoned the jury system completely.
Right. And all the judges who judge the cases also try to ascertain, in most other systems, what the truth is. And we very often you'll have the magistrate also is the one who does the investigating in order to find out what took place. Yeah.
The reason they're doing it is because it's they're trying to, it's innocent until proven guilty. So once the jurors, they come to the court and the defendant is there, they look at him, supposedly it's supposed to be that he's innocent. Prove me that he's guilty. So that's what they bring all the proof.
Well, in Judaism we have that too.
Because that is all systems have the basis that you're innocent. The problem is that it works on the basis that you're supposed to be tried by a jury of your peers. And that you're supposed to be tried by people who are just like you, so that they can ascertain the reasonable man theory. And they don't have to ask a judge what he's doing or she. But it also doesn't really.
But it makes sense, though, because if you go to a crime scene, you see this, like, blood and everything. You get all emotionally involved. You're like, someone's got to be punished for this. You go unjustly blame a guy. But if you just dealt the facts, you don't see the emotional connection to it, so you could be
what
more...
Mean, they try to make emotional things in court all the time to try to sway the jury. They show, like, boring pictures to them and, like, say, that man killed...
That's what they try to do.
Like
that's what they try to do.
Well, right, so it becomes like a... And also, you know, they... what certainly would not be allowed in a Jewish court of law is hired witnesses. In the secular court of law in America, so you can hire expert witnesses, right? You hire experts, ballistics experts for guns, biochemists for DNA, and usually the guy you hire comes out, surprisingly enough, on your side of the equation, right? Which is a total mystery why it should be like that. But so therefore, that entire process, the American system, it's not irrational. Let's make that clear. It seems to work. If everybody in a society accepts upon themselves, you know what? We're not trying to determine what the truth is was, because who knows what the truth was? We can't deal with that. No way of knowing what happened in the past. So we'll have to deal with the case as it's presented in the courtroom, as is in that moment, in the present. If everybody buys into that idea, so it seems that it works. Otherwise, America would never have gotten to where it got today. But it certainly is not the same thing as Jewish law, where they are trying to get at to say the truth. Now, the thing is like this. Even in Judaism, the Rambam says a fascinating thing. The Rambam says, you know, what's the highest form of testimony in Judaism? A proof?
Two
witnesses, right? So the Rambam says, This concept of two witnesses is a choke. A choke. Choke means it's not something which doesn't have a clear-cut reason. The Rambam says, the Torah regarded two witnesses as if they were prophets. So a prophet can come and tell you what happened at the scene of a crime, and of course he's a prophet, he knows. And if two witnesses come, says the Rambam, it's like a prophecy. The Torah gave us the credibility which it gave to a prophet. So the Torah obviously set up a system in which we try to get at the truth, but also the Torah had to say, since we can't go back in time and know what happened, therefore we have to come to some benchmark and say, this is as true as we can get. Beyond this, we're not capable, nor are we required to try and ascertain what happened. So therefore, the Torah said the benchmark of two witnesses, which really is a chok, and the part of that chok, part of that the issue of two witnesses is, which is difficult to fathom, is that if you have two witnesses who come and say Reuven killed Shimon, and 100 witnesses who came and said, no, the other way around. If you have 200 witnesses, 100 witnesses who said Reuben killed Shimon, 1,000 witnesses, 2,000 witnesses, and 2 witnesses who said, no, Reuben did not kill Shimon, you can't kill the guy. What?
Stalemate.
Stalemate, right. So numbers make no difference.
All 23 judges voted unanimously the acquittal of Scott-free.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wait, but what about in that case when you saw they were trying to find the truth?
That's not what I said. It's not the judge. The final ruling can be unanimous. In the deliberations, if none of the judges can find some merit for the guy who's accused, then he can't be killed.
But
the final verdict can be unanimous.
And there's me and you. You're busy watching Joe Schmo. He's pointing the gun at someone's head. We say, do not pull the trigger, we warn you, blah, blah, blah. He says, I accept on myself, I know what I'm doing, I'm in sound body and mind, whatever, and he pops the gun and he shoots him between the eyes. Then obviously every jury and every judge and every deliberation is going to find him guilty of sin.
Not
like, but so he gets
a country? Not in America. They were violating his rights. What were they doing looking in the
yard?
Inadmissible.
He thought of natural cause.
One of them was related to a cop.
Yeah, you're right. It's obviously that can't be in every case. That has to be a case where there is some uncertainty. There's no certainty. It's beyond any shadow of doubt that that wasn't applied.
What happens if there's a case where, let's say, the only two people who saw what went on were non-kosher witnesses, they're gamblers, compulsive gamblers, and they see a guy shoot a guy. So let's say there's 12 gamblers who see a guy kill a guy. In Jewish court, he cannot be executed at all.
No, he can't be found guilty.
Not true.
It's a misconception. You don't even have to ask about that. Ask about women. Right? Women come to court. Bateson can do is administer. Bateson, in the classic sense, has vast powers. Not only that, there was a parallel system which we don't have today either, which is the king system. And the king system of judgment didn't require 2 witnesses. It all required was what the king set as a benchmark of justice, and he could set as a benchmark women, gamblers, whatever he wanted. As long as it was a fair thing, not something which was cruel and evil. Now, even Bateson itself, if they know they have a murderer on hand, even though they don't have definite proof, positive, they don't have testimony, so they have this very interesting mode of putting this guy to death. They put him into a prison, and they give him very little to eat for a certain amount of time, and then they can start giving him barley, cooked barley, which is it causes the stomach to expand and explode. So they have, what's the Gemara telling us? Obviously, it's a very painful death, right? What the Gemara is telling us is that the 4 specific categories of death enumerated in the Torah, which are stoning, burning,
strangulation,
and sword, those can only be imparted on the basis of the witnesses, warning ahead of time, all that kind of stuff. But any other death penalty, any other death you want to impose, because society needs it in order to rid themselves of murderers, go ahead. We'll go right ahead and do it. So it's interesting. I want to make that clear. There are several other cases where exceptions. It's interesting. Mark says a fascinating thing. Mark says a person who transgressed the same prohibition on which you get flogged 3 times, so they kill him too. That's it. We lose patience with the guy, so we just we do
he
the same thing.
Out.
He strikes you out. You're really out. Yes. So there are other ways in which Bateson can accept less than the absolute testimony of where 2 witnesses can impose punishments which go beyond those which the Torah say, but it's primarily in cases of murder. Why? Because the Torah has a special puzzle which says by murder, you have to eradicate the evil from your midst. It's not just a religious crime, it's a social crime. Most crimes for which a person is put to death are religious crimes, right? Shabbos, idolatry, witchcraft, stuff like that. Even adultery. It's not, for the most part, assuming it's consensual, for the most part, those are not crimes which are perpetrated in a way which is rock, which is evil in the sense of from one person to another person. So those crimes, that's where the Torah requires all, in order to kill somebody, such a high level of confidence that, as the Gemara says in some place, that if a Beis Din killed once every 70 years, that already was a murderous court. But by murder, it's not like that. By murder, Beis Din has a special obligation to search down the murderers and eradicate the murder. What?
According to that, then Beis Din has arbitrary powers in order to kill people. If I accuse someone of murder, and I make a very convincing argument, totally lying, Beis Din can kill him.
That's correct.
Okay.
But that's why you needed 23 judges.
Kill that.
They
all have to be convinced that, you know,
they're
crazy.
Well, not all of them, but 13 of them. 13 actually.
They don't really do it like that, you know. They try to give a benefit of the doubt, most of the people. I heard something, I don't know exactly. What was the example?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of people who think that way.
Yeah.
Well,
you know,
I think there's a
Gemara
which says that there was, in order to
the
Beis Din,
there was a certain, I think it was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who in order you talk about the nation?
Suicide.
They're not burying people in a Jewish cemetery.
Oh, they were trying to say that they're not. They were crazy.
They changed their mind in the next.
Yeah. The assumption is nowadays we bury suicides. Strictly speaking, suicides should not have Jewish burial. They should be buried outside a cemetery, and they should not. It should not sit shiva on them. But now, what?
No shiva even.
No shiva. But nowadays we assume that, I don't know if it's justified or not, we assume that anybody who commits suicide must have been crazy, so they're definitely not responsible for their actions.
And it used to be assumed that people would commit suicide without being crazy?
You see, yeah, it seems like it was like the Japanese, you know,
kamikazes,
you know, they were harakiri.
But they get some more of these right-wing, you know, Israelis or whatever, and they get martyrdom or something, and then that's suicide. That's not crazy. I guess you could say it's crazy.
First of all, it's crazy, but besides
right.
that, martyrdom is not the same thing as suicide. They're not self-immolating, you know, they're not pouring gasoline over themselves.
What about like Masada, where they all kill each other?
It was Taka wrong.
What?
It was Taka wrong.
It was
indeed wrong.
Yeah.
It was indeed improper for them to kill themselves.
The only,
wait,
that's
the
only
thing today? If someone commits suicide, they still sit
no,
in and they
no,
murder them in the cemetery because they say, oh, well, I must have been crazy.
Yeah.
I think well, commit suicide besides people who are momentarily. It says you can't do a sin unless you have a lapse of insanity.
It doesn't say a lapse of insanity. It says a spirit of insanity. You know, a spirit of. But it's also there. It says foolishness, not necessarily. No, it's insanity. You're right, but it's not. It's not the same thing as being literally insane.
And suicide is a sin. So
you,
of course,
he did. I know a case where they committed suicide, but they did it for the sake of heaven. And they're in a high place. There's a time.
How do you know they're in a high place?
Huh? I speak to them once in a while.
Really?
Gives me a call.
I don't know. But maybe you should get this year.
Different class.
No,
but I heard that there was time work where the Romans, I think it was the Romans, they used to use these big kids, and they used to use them for.
He's killing himself on the plastic. It's not very efficient.
These sell them, you know, kids.
Oh yeah, for that. For, yeah, you, in order to avoid being used, we say that in the Lamentations on Tisha B'Av, a story about 300 boys and girls who drowned themselves rather than submit to licentious sexual practices. That's permissible.
Yeah.
That's true. Under those circumstances, suicide is permitted.
That's one of the big three, yeah.
What? No, but
three.
Even in anticipation of it. The chiddush there is that even though they were in a boat, nothing happened to them yet. They weren't on the verge of being raped or whatever. But nevertheless, since this was what they were intended for, so therefore in anticipation of that, there's lots of...
Well, they wouldn't have had an opportunity to commit suicide if they had waited until right.
True.
Before.
Okay. Well, okay. The famous story, which we don't know if it's true or not, the famous story that during the Second World War, I say famous because it's told over, and again, nobody knows if it's true, of 93 Beis Yaakov girls who killed themselves with cyanide rather than become prostitutes for the German army.
Actually, the German army raped hardly any Jewish girls.
I don't think they raped
them. It was one of the lowest, you know, rape, like the, for all of, like, you know, they signed certain girls to be prostitutes and stuff. They
right.
even picked non-Jewish girls.
Well, I guess it makes sense if they picked non-Jewish first, right.
Yeah, they said that we were
infected.
That's why, like, German Jewish rape is actually one of the lowest in any war in history. Because they thought you were so contaminated.
Mm. Again, the nobody knows the names of these 93 girls, so nobody knows if it's true or not true. But there's a very moving letter which somebody wrote, and again, we don't know if the letter is real or forged, as if it was written by one of these girls who's about to commit suicide. So our acceptance to the rule, but there are also cases where, you know, a person goes out of his mind. I thought this is what you were saying. There's certain persons where cases where people go out of their mind because of religion and commit suicide.
You go up here.
We didn't commit suicide, committed murder. But one of my Rosh Hashiva once told me about once told us in the class about a young scholar of great note. I don't know who he was, I don't know when it was, but somebody who was acquainted with, who learned a lot of Musar, obviously in a negative way, and one day he decided he was just too stricken with sin and too imperfect to go on, and he poured gasoline over himself and set himself on fire. And on the way to the ambulance to the hospital, as they heard him say, repeating to himself, chapters from the Mesilat Yesharim, one of the basic Musar books, or verbally, you know, with Baal Peh, from memory. So, you know, there's a danger that a person sometimes abuses religion, and as a result, they come to suicide.
We have in Islam, they have a very big tie.
What?
The terrorists.
Yeah.
You know, they just try the best of that.
That's why the Torah tells us many times that you have to be moderate, not extreme. Extremism is bad.
I think Christianity comes in, because, like, if you're someone's a Christian, then why the longer you're on the earth, the more sins you're going to do, so why don't you just go to heaven now and just go to confession and then kill yourself right afterwards? That would be the best thing. Apparently, I think they said that, like, if you commit suicide, go to hell or something.
Right, there's a rule against it.
Otherwise, everyone would go to confession and kill themselves. Why bother?
Sure, makes sense. Okay, we'll stop here for today.
Now Christians killing themselves. Continue tomorrow.
I'll let you know.